Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. The world of social media is a fascinating place where information is at your fingertips and connections with family and friends around the world are just a few mouse clicks away. Major news outlets and corporations use social media to deliver messages to the masses, keeping the public informed and delivering important bits of information immediately, which advocates say keeps the community safer and better informed. But for all the benefits of social media, there are unique drawbacks and disadvantages too, from giving people a license to be hurtful to facilitating misinformation, frauds, and scams. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seawort. Today we discuss the psychology of social media and explore what prompts the polarization that is all too common in online interaction. Joining us today from the University of Wisconsin is Dr. Catalina Toma, Associate Professor of Communication Science. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Toma.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also joining us today is Dr. Kim Buchanan, a Professor of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Dr. Buchanan, thank you for being here today.
It's great to be here. Thank you for hosting this conversation.
You bet. You can join the conversation, too, by calling us at 800-780-9742. You can email us as well at route51@wpr.org. Callers, please allow plenty of time for our producer to answer your call. I'd like to start by asking about the advantages of social media. You know, personally, I have to say I love being connected with family members and even long-lost high school friends on Facebook and Twitter. My adult children, I know they keep connected through Snapchat, for example. So why do you think so many people are drawn to these social media channels? What do you think, Dr. Buchanan?
Well, I think it's important that we start by emphasizing that Catalina and I are both very pro-media, we're pro-technology. We see a lot of good, and you just alluded to some of it. You know, if a grandparent is staying in touch with her grandchildren through Facebook, I'm not going to tell her to get off Facebook. Or if a business is publicizing their hours or their current events, that's great. I think that right now, in this moment, with everything we're living through, we see a lot of what we sometimes call fear of missing out. We fear missing important information. We're worried about being conned or misled, particularly in an election season. And we feel very real threats to our jobs, to our family, our community, our values. And so we have this need to connect with other people. But at the same time, we're trying to navigate a lot of information that could be emotionally activating.
Catalina, what do you think are some of the best things that have come out of the birth of social media? I mean, you're both very pro-technology, and I have to say I am too.
Yeah, Kim made a great point. I became interested in studying social media because of its potential. I was just fascinated by all of the things that we could do with social media that we couldn't do before. And I should say that this was kind of early 2000, so social media has developed quite a bit since then. For me, one of the most important aspects of social media is the ability to initiate and foster and maintain relationships. There's a lot of cost to meeting people in face-to-face settings and a lot of cost to relationship maintenance. You got to call, you got to see people, you got to stay in touch with them. And we're all very busy, and our ability to stay in touch with people over long periods of time can be diminished. Well, social media, some of these costs are reduced. So if we take online dating, for example, it's much easier to connect with lots of people and meet single individuals that you might not be able to meet face-to-face in a much more convenient setting. And with social networking sites, we get news from our friends, sometimes distant friends, that we wouldn't have been in touch with otherwise. So it's allowing us to maintain connections that would have been dormant or would have died in the absence of social media. And it's allowing us to keep in touch even with closer friends at a low cost. It doesn't take a lot to give a like and to give comments and to share information with people online. So for me, these are some of the, you know, primary benefits of social media and a big reason why I think social media is so attractive to many people.
Kim, you've said that our social media choices illustrate our mindsets, including the lenses we use to understand the world. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes, thank you for asking. I do a lot of work trying to understand where courage comes from, including the courage of a kid to raise their hand in class, or the courage of somebody to admit that they have feelings for somebody. And we look at the world through through our mindsets and our lenses, and we see perhaps opportunities to learn, opportunities to better understand somebody, or with a different mindset, say prejudice or fear, we interpret the same information, especially ambiguous information in social media, as a threat, or somebody being impatient with us, or somebody deriding our values. And so we really should stop and think about what preconceptions am I bringing? What am I expecting to find? And where am I in my emotional state? Because all those things, all those parts of our inner life are actually going to affect what we interpret off the screen.
I have to wonder, too, if the way we interpret what we see on social media can sometimes be colored by the fact that it's just not in person. I mean, it's the same as if you're texting someone or sending an email. Emotion doesn't always come out the way that we intend it to. Do you think that really plays a role in what we see?
Yes. In fact, Catalina and I were just talking about that on the break, that we have a lot of capacity as human beings to watch somebody's facial expression, to watch their body language, to listen to their tone of voice. And 140 characters does not capture that nuance. And so right away we get a little bit anxious because our brain isn't getting the information we want about this relationship and how this person feels. And we often confront our own, you know, I'm 44 years old. I'm not nearly as tech savvy as my teenagers, and I'm aware of that as I teach my students online, for instance. And so there's a lot of anxiety that feeds into our interpretation, and that can bring out the worst in us, our insecurities, our fears, the ways in which we poorly judge ourselves. And so it's like we're working uphill to make those kind of connections that social media can give us, that Catalina referred to, the friendships, the collegiality, even the romantic relationships.
I have to wonder, too, Catalina, why do you think so many people freely give their information away online? Sometimes, I mean, I can be a little bit mystified by this, from relationship statuses to like those quirky quizzes. So much information is being publicly shared. Why do they give that information? And do you think there's any risk to that?
The phenomenon of sharing or oversharing is really, really interesting to me. I should say that sharing is kind of a fundamental aspect of experiencing emotion. Whenever people experience an emotional event, they feel compelled to share it with others. And that's as part of people's attempts to regulate those emotions. When we talk to other people, we can get social support. If we're experiencing something negative, we can work through our thoughts and feelings. And if we're experiencing something positive, we can capitalize on that. Research shows that just the act of talking to somebody about a positive event makes you feel even better about that event than you felt before. So emotion is a big impetus for sharing. And we share face-to-face. We also share online quite easily because it is easy, because it is convenient. A lot of these technologies are in our pockets. So it's they're much more accessible, and they render the act of sharing way easier. Also, we get to connect with large audiences online, and this is something that is really fascinating to me. If we think about it, never ever in history has the average person been able to access such large audiences as they do now. We can connect with hundreds, sometimes thousands of people at the click of a button on social media, which was never possible before. So the amount of attention and feedback that we can get online is much increased. Of course, there's individual differences. Some people share a lot, some people share a little. But on the average, we see quite a bit of sharing online, and a lot of it is done for the purpose of emotional regulation, for the purpose of connection, and for the joy of getting attention and engaging in conversation.
Well, there is a joy in getting attention. I mean, when you say your child achieves something and you share that on social media and you get that warm, fuzzy feeling when people are giving you those likes and loves and, hey, way to go. Sure, it does feel good. But is there ever a risk involved in that? Kim, what do you think?
Well, I want to riff on something that Catalina just said, and I think she's making some good points. There's some time and convenience advantages here. You know, I've got my phone. I can take it out in a couple minutes. I can like your post. I can put in a little heart emoji. I can say, you know, sending you hugs and prayers. But that's not the same as having a sit-down, face-to-face conversation or even getting on the phone for 10 or 15 minutes to really talk through and listen to somebody else. And I think we all want to be heard. I think we're all tweeting and posting and sharing quite a lot right now, but we sometimes feel like we're not being heard, and that might be because the feedback we're getting can be so fleeting. It takes an investment of time and energy to get there. And to your question, a colleague of mine, Megan Moreno, really focuses on pediatrics and psychology. She likes to use the phrase super peer, that when we're getting information through a screen, it simultaneously feels like the media, like a big television network giving us information, important journalism, but it's also our friends. And so it can do interesting things to our psychology, and we maybe put simultaneously more importance on other people's feedback, but it can also feel very thin if it's just a heart emoji when I'm really going through something big.
True. So, social media can also be really addictive too. I mean, we hear about that a lot. People are they're glued to it all day long. What makes it so addictive? Catalina, what do you think?
Yes. Well, we have some of the smartest people in the world working for Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and their job is to give us content that is tailored and as customized as possible, and they're damn good at it. The ability of getting information from users on these social media platforms is enormous, and then these companies are developing algorithms that can detect your preferences and give you exactly what you want. So that's a big aspect of it that we cannot ignore. The other aspect is the human factor, which is, you know, social media in a way is like a tabloid, except instead of reading about celebrities, we read about our friends. And that's intrinsically interesting and intrinsically fascinating. As long as humans have existed, we've wanted to gossip, we've wanted to know what our social circles are up to, and we've wanted to get information from them. So all of these factors contribute to the amount of time that we spend on the screen.
Do you think there are certain personality types that are more likely to participate or share information on social media? Or are there certain personality types that are more likely to take things at face value, for example? Kim, what are your thoughts?
Well, going back to my model of mindsets, we all find adaptive ways to be in the world, and part of my job as a professor is really try to understand my students and be open and vulnerable to them. But I think about somebody doing a different kind of job or doing my job differently, and I think absolutely. I think some of us gravitate towards fields where we're comfortable with the level of vulnerability that's there. And throughout my career as an educator, I've tried to be more vulnerable and present with my students to be more approachable to them because I care about doing my job well. But I imagine, you know, police officers get very different training about their ability to project authority and implacability. So your mileage may vary. To your question about addiction, that's a very loaded word in psychology. I've had a lot of conversations with people about this. Just to get it out there, in psychology, we talk a lot now about problematic internet use as characterized by maybe difficulty logging off or feeling an attachment to your cell phone. So if it's missing, you feel panic and impulsive behavior. We see this especially among teenagers and young adults sharing things that maybe they shouldn't and maybe even kind of celebrating that impulsive, like, oh, no, you didn't. I can't believe you shared this kind of behavior. And that actually goes back to Catalina's point about time and convenience. I mean, on the one hand, these platforms are ostensibly designed for us to take just a couple minutes and check on my status updates, maybe like and share a few posts or whatever. But my students, my 20-something university students, report being on these platforms for hours, just continuously scrolling, and that's potentially problematic.
You're listening to Dr. Kim Buchanan from UW Stevens Point and Dr. Catalina Toma from the University of Wisconsin, our guests today on Route 51, talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly in social media. You can join the conversation, too, by calling 800-780-9742 or email your questions and comments to route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Dr. Catalina Toma from the University of Wisconsin and Dr. Kim Buchanan from UW Stevens Point are here today for a discussion on social media, which can be something of a double-edged sword when it comes to staying connected with friends, family, and the world. We'll take your questions, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. You can email us, too. The email address is route51@wpr.org. I'm sometimes astonished to read comments on social media, especially those posted on news sites, because it sometimes feels like people speak much more freely online than they ever would in person. Sometimes those comments are shocking. I mean, the vitriol that sometimes spews from people from people's keyboards rather than their mouths in person. What is it about social media that seems to give people this license to be hurtful, saying things that they would never say to somebody's face? What do you think, Catalina?
Yeah, I have a lot of insights in that. Actually, we do quite a bit of research on that in our lab. The main framework that we take to this question is the possibility that there's an intensification effect. When we go online, the way that we understand and we connect with other people gets distorted by the medium in which the interaction occurs. And one of the big distortions is that we actually have very little information about the people we are talking to. We can see them, we can hear them, we interact based on snippets of information. And sometimes people share very benign things that don't activate a great deal of emotion, but sometimes people share deeply felt emotional things and beliefs that they hold dearly, especially in this political environment that we live in today. So when we don't have a lot of information about our interlocutor, the only thing that we hear or read about them is an opinion that is extreme to us, right, that we feel very strongly about, we tend to respond in kind of this intensified, exaggerated way. So we might think that they're all good or all bad according to our own preconceived ideas. So you know, if I am leaning a certain way politically and I'm seeing information from somebody who's leaning completely differently and that's all I see and that's all I hear about them, I tend to respond in an intensified and exaggerated way compared to face-to-face. So that's why people kind of get into it and would say things online that they might not say face-to-face. And I should say that this dynamic works similarly for positive presentations as well. We can form deep connections and perceive a lot of affinity with people we don't know quite well just because we feel that we agree or share a view that's really important or central to us. And that's one of the reasons why people tend to fall in love quite quickly online and to develop relationships quite quickly. And then maybe those relationships suffer once you meet face to face, once you have more elaborate interactions, because then you discover the person in the fullness of their humanity, right? You get a lot more information about them.
What is it about negative and hostile interactions that drives engagement rather than harmony? Kim, what's going on in our minds here when this is happening?
That's an excellent question. I think it's one of the most important questions. I want to riff a bit on something both of you have said. So as a psychologist, I'm very interested in how you get certain behavior, behavior from a student in a classroom or behavior from somebody on a first date. And we have to look at the context where that behavior happened. So I'm going to make a metaphor here. I want to talk about a casino. You walk into a casino and you know the odds are against you. You're probably going to lose money, but there's a lot of things in the environment that affect how you think and how you behave. There's no windows, there's no clocks, alcohol is cheap and plentiful, and all those things occasion certain behaviors or catalyze certain behaviors. Now, I'm not hating on casinos, but I'm saying walking into the casino, we should be mindful, hey, these people are here to make money. They want my money. And so am I getting an experience in exchange that I want, or am I just being exploited? I know people who gamble for fun, and that's fine, but gambling can also be problematic. So now let's talk about what Catalina just alluded to, the way these systems are set up. These are businesses. They're trying to make a profit. If you're using social media and it's free, that means you're the product, that they're collecting your information, they're using your engagement as an engine for profit. They're not like public libraries or public radio, which are also free, but have a very different business model. They need to make money, but we don't want to spend money. We want these things for free. And so they end up blurring lines around facts and opinions and conspiracy theories and especially advertisements And these systems are built to promote what they sometimes call user engagement and time on platform. So when my 20-year-old student is scrolling and scrolling for hours, that's making money for the company that they're scrolling on. And what they've figured out, they've set up these systems, these algorithms. What keeps people on the platform? What leads them to watch the whole video? What leads them to like and share the video? It's our hot emotions. It's anger and outrage and fear and shock and disgust. And it's like they're all colored with the same bright red crayon. And those are the behaviors and emotions that get people likes, that get them shared, that get them the peer acclaim that we all tend to crave.
Do some platforms tend to encourage or discourage more negative behaviors than others? I mean, are there differences between, say, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Snapchat? You know, are there some that are not so that don't necessarily embrace that type of algorithm, or are they all like that?
Well, I to be clear, I'm not trying to malign any particular person here, although we do know that there are third-party bad actors that take advantage of these to try to manipulate us around elections, for instance. I don't want to speak to any particular company, but just to recognize that if the company's values are to make a lot of money for their shareholders, then the people down the ladder are being told, keep these people on the platform, and so they're experimenting with different technologies. Now, on the other side of this, when we see organizations or even nations try to intervene in areas where social media is involved. I'm thinking about some of the horrific stories coming out of places like Eastern Europe or Ethiopia, where certain social media platforms have been used to spread hate speech or even incite violence. When an organization or even a nation comes to that company and says, your platform is being used for dangerous and destructive purposes, can we get your help in tracking down these bad actors? Can we get your help in maybe imposing some law enforcement and some justice? Different companies respond differently to that request. And I think we as consumers should pay attention to the ethics that are driving those decisions.
Turning back to individual behavior, there's also the dog pile phenomenon we see on Twitter. It's kind of a ganging up, if you will. Catalina, can you explain that? Why do people engage in that kind of behavior, that ganging up on somebody?
We are extremely social creatures, right? As a species, we rely on others for feedback and support, and we tend to experience a lot of emotional contagion and a lot of behavioral contagion. So when people feel like they're getting support from a crowd, they are emboldened and they act in more extreme ways and they contribute to the conversation. So what we're seeing is, you know, a lot of interactions where people feel supported and they continue their behavior because of that encouragement. Now, whether that support extends more broadly or not is unclear, because people tend to respond to others who are similar to them and to engage with others who are similar to them. So social media could create a distorted perception that your perspective maybe or your behavior is more widely endorsed or more widely supported than it actually is. And that's something we need to be careful about.
Building on that a little bit, Kim,
there's an interesting study of teenage boys and what they share, and it would horrify some people, the kinds of sort of shock pornography or really inflammatory political memes. And what these boys end up reporting privately is they feel like in order to stay in the peer group, in order to be accepted by their peers, they have to laugh it off. They have to say, oh, you know, that rape joke was so funny. I can't believe you shared that kind of thing. But inside, privately, they recognize that they might be perpetuating some really toxic and dangerous values. But we want to belong. We want to be part of our group, especially more than ever. We don't want to feel alone.
But Kim, what about trolls? Why do some people stoke the fires of internet disagreement on purpose?
Oh, this is such an important question, and I encourage all parents and role models to talk to young kids and teenagers about this behavior. The short version is computer enemies are boring. So I come from a gaming background. I play a lot of multiplayer games online, and they've yet to create a computer-controlled enemy that's nearly as interesting as a human being. When I show up and I fight an enemy in a game, they're probably going to behave the same way every time. And there are certain people who begin to recognize that it might be more fun, and I put that in quotes, it might be more fun to get an emotional rise out of somebody, to mess up their experience and to watch people express this outrage or shock or anger. And that's dangerous because if you're in a peer group that affirms that, that's like, oh, you know, check out how you made this person lose their control, or check out how this person is now buying into this conspiracy theory. That's going to reward the behavior.
Exactly. Some people get a rise out of getting attention and out of manipulating people. And there are studies that show relationships between the dark triad of personality traits, so narcissism, psychopathology, Machiavellianism, and trolling behavior. And it's a similar concept to the phenomenon of duping delight. Perhaps you've heard of that, the joy that some people get out of fooling others and lying to others. Same dynamics play out online. And that's not to say that these individuals only operate online. They definitely operate face-to-face as well. But in some ways, it might be possible to get even more attention, even more easily online than face-to-face.
How does bias propagate on social media? Kim, what are your thoughts?
Well, again, we want to look at these systems and the way in which computer programmers create these systems, and they're assisted by psychologists. And then the systems are sort of let loose to learn and to pay attention to what kinds of accounts seem to be the most popular and making sure that their content is pushed to the front, and what kinds of posts and content get liked and shared. And there is a lot of fear out there, rightfully. We've got unemployment issues, we've got social justice issues, we've got concerns about the police. And so bias on all sides, again, it's that bright red crayon. It's seeing the world through a particular lens, and it can be very affirming. And fundamentally, bias comes from an us versus them. I can feel more part of my group if we collectively bully another kid, or if we collectively cyberbully another kid online. And bias is just that writ large, whether we're talking about race or gender or LGBTQ plus issues.
I agree, if I can add on to that. These algorithms are extremely effective in giving us content that is emotionally interesting, emotionally arousing, just like we've discussed before, because we find emotion intrinsically engaging. And also fulfilling our confirmation bias, giving us information that is consistent with the information that we already hold, because those interactions tend to be more pleasant and more engaging for us. We like to be told that we're right, and we like to have people agree with us, and we like to form our little in-group of people who are like-minded. So these algorithms contribute to the formation of those biases in ways that could be quite problematic, and that lots of social scientists are studying in a political context because it's just so relevant there. There's another bias that we've been studying in our lab that's more of a relational matter, and that affects people's emotional well-being, perhaps in ways that were unintended and quite dysfunctional. One such bias is the idea that we don't understand just how curated people's presentations of their own lives are online. So, you know, when users go on Facebook or Instagram to present aspects of their lives, they tend to exhibit this positivity bias. They tend to share the more glamorous and pleasant and fulfilling aspects, like vacations and trips and successes and accomplishments, because those tend to get a lot of attention. But for some reason, there's a disconnect between what people do and what they think other people do. So oftentimes, users don't realize that everybody else is doing what they're doing. And as a result of that, they can develop distorted perceptions of how much more fulfilling and happy other people's lives are compared to their own. And that has been associated with envy and jealousy and depression in the short term with social media activity, especially for young people.
So let's talk
a moment. I think that curation point is really excellent. Not only do we curate our individual experiences, but what we're receiving through social media is really curated by these systems. When I was growing up, there were three television networks putting out the news, and they had to try to appeal to everybody. As a professor, I teach Democrats, Republicans, and other, and I have to teach in a way that connects with all of them. But micro-targeted ads and a curated social media feed can just really perpetuate a biased worldview.
What about the fake news that we see on social media? So much misinformation. I know Facebook and Twitter, they say they're working to combat it, but it's still so prevalent. So one of the big questions I have when I scroll through my feed And I see somebody posting something that's so obviously false. Is how can they believe that stuff? So why do people believe the outlandish things they see, whether it's a meme or a news story, something that's so obviously not real? What do you think?
Well, there's two reasons we can think about. And I think the one that social media is capitalizing upon and is really salient there is the notion of social endorsement and heuristic processing. Let me explain what I mean about by that. On social media, we have loads of information at our fingertips. So we cannot engage very deeply with each and every piece of information we encounter. Because of that, we rely on heuristics. Heuristics are kind of cognitive shortcuts to determine whether something is interesting or trustworthy and so on and so forth. And that's where social endorsement comes into play. So if this article is shared by somebody I trust, then I'll intrinsically trust it as well. I won't spend the cognitive effort involved in making deep judgments about the credibility of that article. So that's a real danger. We tend to rely on things that our friends share much more so than on things that strangers would share or that we might see on the news. There's already a stamp of approval associated with that if it's been shared by somebody we trust. The other is the confirmation bias that I mentioned before. If the piece of news is consistent with the worldview that you already hold, it's much easier to accept it and to not challenge it. In fact, most people don't engage in that kind of deeper sort of challenging if it's something that you already accept, even though it's maybe moving you a little bit farther than your initial belief. So all of those dynamics play out on social media in important ways, I think.
Kim, did you want to build on that a little bit?
Oh, that's very well put. I think we're thinking about the same kinds of things. We want to be kind to ourselves, and I want to emphasize that. We're lazy, busy people, and I want to keep my family safe. I want to know whether I'm going to be laid off. I want to know whether my rights are being threatened. And I don't feel like I have enough time. And so, yeah, I resort to shortcuts. I resort to heuristics. I try to trust sources to make some information filtering for me. And we should be kind to ourselves about that, but we should also recognize that anxiety is really compromising sometimes our judgment, our attention, our energy.
You're listening to Dr. Kim Buchanan from UW-Stevens Point and Dr. Catalina Toma from the University of Wisconsin, our guests today on Route 51, talking about the psychology of social media. When we return, some tips on coping with difficult online experiences. You can join the conversation, too, by calling us at 800-780-9742 or email your questions and comments to Route51 at WPR.org. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Dr. Catalina Toma from the University of Wisconsin and Dr. Kim Buchanan from UW-Stevens Point are here today for a discussion on social media and the polarization that can result from online interactions. We'll take your questions, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call. You can email us, too, at route51@wpr.org. During election season especially, exchanges on social media, even between friends and family members, can get especially heated. In fact, I went on a snooze spree just yesterday, having to mute some of the folks in my feed. It can be really hard to just walk away. Sometimes those interactions can damage relationships for years to come. So, Dr. Buchanan, what are some of the things that we should and shouldn't do when we're faced with online hostility from people we care about?
Well, I'm going to start with the message again to be kind, to remind ourselves where this person is coming from. And they have anxieties and they have fears about their job, about their family. And so when they see political candidates saying things that they think are going to hurt them, they're responding from a place of fear and anxiety. The advice I give to my future teachers, I say if you're not happy with a student's behavior, one of your best choices is to talk to them privately one-on-one. And that certainly applies to social media. If somebody is making a big show of promoting an opinion that you disagree with or promoting something you think is false, don't try to engage with them in front of everybody. Try to communicate with them privately. Try to be kind. And just try to present your other point of view. There's lots of good advice out there. I'd encourage listeners to Google stick up for truth, like stick, the word stick up for truth, there's good advice, and it echoes those kinds of things. Being discreet and really focusing on the relationship and letting the person know that you're also scared, but here's how you arrived maybe at a different conclusion.
I mean, what is that? I think that's truly excellent advice, and that's what I tell my students as well. If interactions get very heated online with people we care about, with friends and family members, I think it's just a real shame to terminate relationships over these disagreements. And I think it's important to understand how the medium kind of distorts our interactions in the ways that I've explained earlier. We tend to become much more emotionally engaged, and there's a lot of emotional intensification. And we also tend to exhibit a lot of self-focus. We don't focus so much on our partner because information about them is limited by virtue of them not being in front of us. We can't see their face. We can see their gestures. We can't interact in the way that we're accustomed to face-to-face. Online, the focus is on us and our private experiences much more on them. So I think migrating those interactions from online to face-to-face in those heated moments, I think, is a really great suggestion. And trying to see the humanity and the intentions and the vulnerabilities in both of us. I think that's great advice. The other advice that I would have that was inspired by your snoozing comment earlier, I think it's important to recognize that emotion is contagious, not just face-to-face, but also online. We catch people's emotions based on the things that they say on social media as well as the things that they say face-to-face. So it is totally okay to take a break or to unfollow or to snooze certain people whose posts are making us emotionally engage in a negative way. And lots of people tend to have kind of all or nothing views on technology. They tend to get really upset with Facebook or Twitter and so on and so forth, and they want to cut it off completely. Research shows that that actually doesn't work. People tend to come back because there's a lot of usefulness to these platforms in addition to the dangers that they exhibit. So rather than taking an all or nothing approach like that, it is wise to recognize when the periods of time in your life are that are vulnerable, when you might want to protect yourself from these negative emotions and disengage at those times.
Catalina, earlier you touched on this. When we browse through social media platforms, we tend to be barraged with photos of people who seem to be having the best time of their lives. As you said, people tend to put the good things out. They don't necessarily put the bruises of their lives out for everyone to see. So sometimes when we see all these, the travel and the high grades and the achievements, it can really trigger insecurity about our own lives. How can we cope with those feelings?
Absolutely, especially if we're feeling vulnerable for some reason or another. Maybe we're going through a difficult time personally. That may not be the time to be exposed to this glamorized information. So again, understanding your own emotional space and understanding the distorted and glamorized features of the media is really important. So when you are feeling vulnerable, it is okay to disengage and say, I'm not going to do this right now. It's not good for me to see all of these overly positive self-presentation online. The other thing to understand is that we're connected with hundreds and thousands of people online. So statistically speaking, somebody's going to have truly a good time when we're having a bad time. But other people are also going to have a bad time, it's just that it's obscured. So we're seeing aggregate self-presentations as opposed to individualized self-presentation. That contributes to the distorted perceptions that we might have about how other people are constantly successful and we're just the only ones who are failing. That is not accurate. It's important to recognize that. But also it's important to recognize how easy it is to go down the garden path of believing that others are doing better than us and disengage during those vulnerable times.
Kim, you talked about kids, and there has certainly been a lot of focus on the devastating impact of online bullying on teens and preteens. We could do a whole show on that. I feel like years ago when I was a kid, if I was on the phone with a friend with a cord stretched in the bathroom with the door closed, my parents would know immediately if something was wrong. Now, a lot of this stuff happens behind the veil of internet secrecy. It's not the same as when I was a kid, that's for sure. So things are happening on cell phones, tablets, laptops. What can parents do about that? What are the right limits for parents to set?
I think that's a really good point, and I echo what I said earlier, that I think some of us would be really disturbed if we saw what especially young men between the ages of like 14 and 25 are sharing on social media, and that perpetuates all sorts of problematic behavior in real life. I think role modeling is huge here. I think the way we as parents model using social media to our kids can be hugely impactful. The social media platform I use the most is Discord. It's a chat program, and my daughters are on one of the servers. And so I sometimes think about the choices that I'm making because they can see me interacting with my friends and the choices I make. Role modeling is huge. I think demonstrating the digital equivalent of counting to 10, you don't have to respond right away. You could walk away. All of us have composed an email but hesitated before hitting send. You know, take 30 minutes, see if it's still a good idea. And then really try to help kids understand that your behavior expectations are the same whether they're at school or at church or at home or on the internet. That the anonymity and the convenience can really make it seem like this is more like a game or it's not quite real. My words can't hurt people the same way. My choices can't hurt people the same way. And that's not true. So teaching good digital citizenship, I can tell you a lot of K-12 teachers are trying to communicate these messages to kids, and we as parents and role models can try to do the same around good digital citizenship. And as more of us spend more of our life on the internet, it's really up to us to decide what kind of sort of public street we want to have.
Catalina, what are your thoughts?
I completely agree. I think media literacy is what matters here because we're never going to go back to a world of less technology. We're just going to go forward to a world of more technology. And if anything, the COVID-19 social distancing and stay-at-home orders have intensified our reliance on technology. It's inescapable right now. So it's useless to say I'm just going to not allow my kids to go online. Rather, a much healthier approach is to understand what kind of different activities can happen online, what kind of benefits and costs are associated with all of those activities, how the individual platforms work, and start talking to our kids on how to develop media literacy. And understanding things like, you know, one of the things that we haven't talked about is recordability, how things that you say on the internet are perpetual. They're there to stay, and they no longer belong to you after you post them there. So on the one hand, in the case of cyberbullying, this can make messages much more hurtful if you send them. But on the other hand, it can make it easier for you to get caught if you've engaged in these kinds of behaviors. And there's a record of it that can be analyzed and preserved. So understanding those nuances becomes really important. It's also hard for parents. Many of them didn't grow up with social media and have maybe not as nuanced understanding of these issues. These issues are complex. I teach them to my students, right? They take classes on that. So moving to a world where there's more education for parents and for young people about how to acquire media literacy is really important.
You mentioned about those social media posts. Can they ever really be entirely deleted, or is it always somewhere floating out there?
I mean, it's a hard question. Some people think that you can retrieve anything. I don't have the technological expertise to make those claims, but I will tell you that in many cases, it is fair to say that it's very difficult to delete things. They'll pop up in one way or the other.
Well, talking about some of the positive things that social media has done for us, one of the ways the U.S. military and the Department of Veterans Affairs uses social media is they're using it to help prevent suicide with targeted campaigns that have really helped to disarm social stigmas like anxiety and depression. And yet, on the flip side, social media use can exacerbate these issues and it can put some people at higher risk, as we alluded to earlier. Kim, how can you balance that?
I think again, role modeling is pretty big here. We get a lot of mailers right now because of the season and the state we live in, and most of them go from the mailbox to the recycling bin. But I try to stop and talk to my daughter about what I just read and why I disagree or why I agree with it. And so I think representation also matters here, helping people understand that they don't have to front, that they don't have to pretend to be better than they are. You know, Catalina uses the excellent word glamorizing. We all feel this pressure to be our better selves or to live our best lives on social media. And it can be really relieving to some people to say, you know, I live with this issue or I struggle with this too, and I'm not perfect, but I'm still succeeding.
I know that when we get on social media, we open up our Facebook feeds, we open up our Twitter feeds, we can be overloaded with information. I mean, a barrage of information. Most of it is irrelevant to our daily lives. How do you sift through the noise to ensure you're able to absorb and process the information that's most relevant to us? Catalina, what do you think?
That's an excellent point. There is a barrage of information, unprecedentedly so, and one of the challenges of social media companies and of users is to sift through it. That's why we have algorithms, right, that curate that information for us and that certainly facilitate information processing and give us things that we're actually interested in, but at the same time can have important drawbacks that we've touched upon earlier, like the confirmation bias. A lot of people's social media use is driven by media habits. So once we form a habit, it tends to perpetuate. We actually have the entire internet at our fingertips, but if we consider carefully where we go online, it's actually a pretty limited number of websites because that's the habit that we formed. Precisely because, as we've discussed earlier, and Kim excellently put it, we are cognitive misers. We can't process all that amount of information. Our lives are really busy. We have a lot going on. So we have to rely on shortcuts.
I think that's excellent, and it speaks to the importance I put on mindsets. Checking our habits. Am I asking important questions like, is this factual? How do I know? Why was it sent to me? What behavior are they trying to get from me? Could this be Photoshop? Could this be a deep fake? Just catching ourselves in our media consumption to stop and pause and say, why did this come to me? What is somebody trying to do? Are they trying to keep me better informed, or are they trying to manipulate me?
So what is the most effective way to vet the content you find on social media? Touched on that just a little bit earlier in the program, Kim. You talked about the stick up for truth. What are some tips to vet that content that you're seeing to see if it's real or not?
Well, I like to go back to the business model. Well, not because I think they're necessarily bad actors there in the businesses, but what is their motive? And so, you know, I'm a proud supporter of NPR. I know where the money goes and what the mission is. The social media platform I like is Discord, and I pay them, and so there aren't ads. We want to think about that, like, what's my relationship to this company? And then also, I agree that just totally disconnecting is a bad choice, but not responding impulsively. Like Catalina said, emotion is contagious. So to count to 10, to do the digital equivalent of counting to 10 and say, well, wait a minute, what are my values? What are my beliefs? What's my relationship to this person? And what do I want that relationship to be after this election is over? What's my long-term investment here? And not just get triggered by the first emotion I feel.
Do you think it's beneficial to take a social media break? Catalina mentioned that earlier.
I think it needs to be in balance. There's a wonderful author Sherry Turkle, and she's got this great quote I like, what technology makes easy is not always what nurtures the human spirit. Or to put it another way, you don't want to live on Doritos and pop all day. That doom scrolling, hours and hours of little tiny dopamine hits and little tiny moments of outrage and anger and stuff like that, that's not the same as kicking back and watching a movie or reading a book. So I think we want to treat social media as more of a snack food. But if we really want to understand an issue, that's long-form journalism. That's spending some time reading some Wikipedia. And that's not the same, but it's more substantive.
One final quick question for you, Catalina. What is some final tips on how to manage difficult social media situations? What can we do to limit the downside of those interactions?
Well, I think for me, it's understanding. It's just understanding how human beings operate, understanding how we operate personally, what our triggers may be, what our strengths may be, what kind of information puts us into an emotional space that's likely to spiral out of control. I think it's really, really important. So going back to that issue of media literacy, understanding how those social media platform functions, and going back to emotional intelligence and self-regulation, so understanding how we function and existing in that space in between.
Thank you. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. I'd like to thank our guests, Dr. Catalina Toma from the University of Wisconsin and Dr. Kim Buchanan from UW Stevens Point. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, we'll take a look at the current state of the COVID-19 pandemic 7 months after Governor Tony Evers' initial shutdown order from a scientific and health perspective. And in 2 weeks, a discussion on K-12 education and how schools are meeting challenges presented by the pandemic situation. If you have questions for guests or an idea for a future program, email us at route51@wpr.org. Until next week, we're heading out of town.